Next case is 001725, Philip Charbat.
Charbat versus Dispatch Consumer Services, Inc.
Mr. Charbat.
May it please the court, I'm Philip Charbat, the plaintiff. With me at council table is Mr. Robert Biggerstaff, who appears as amicus curiae in support of appellant. I would like to address some of the substantive administrative agency arguments. Amicus will address the judicial doctrines underlying the agency law of this case, as well as constitutional issues. I would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. The Telephone Consumer Protection Act provides a consumer with the ability to hang a do not call sign, not solicit sign, on his telephone that all solicitors must obey. This case is about the right to enforce that no soliciting sign. I told appellees to cease calling, and they continued to do so. They have therefore made illegal trespasses into my home. An analogy directly on point would be a painter contracted to paint the outside of your home who then wanders to the inside of the home during the work to start a conversation about additional work. You have the right to inform him to leave the interior of your home and not to return. He is still contractually obligated to finish his work, but has been put on notice that his trespasses to the interior of your home will not be tolerated. Just 8 years ago, this question was before this very court, which held that a person may exclude a speaker just like any other trespasser from private property. There was no requirement that Beulah Park cease its business relations with Bresnik, only that Beulah Park could compel Bresnik to refrain from trespassing upon its property. Indeed, Bresnik maintained this business relationship with Beulah Park, and this is an excellent example of where a property owner enforced communication constraints against a trespasser with whom he is obligated to continue to do business. This court held, quote, the power to exclude has traditionally been considered one of the most important treasured strands in an owner's bundle of property rights, unquote. Would your bank's loan officer have the right to enter your home after you've told them to leave to pitch a second mortgage?
Counsel,
of course not.
Were you still receiving the Sunday newspaper at the time of these phone calls?
Yes.
So at no time had you severed relationships with the newspaper?
Correct.
Isn't that a requirement?
No, it's not. The FCC has issued official clarifications and orders that you only have to tell them to cease calling. You're not required to sever business relationships. There's no such language in any of their official clarifications.
Okay.
Mr. Charbat, you've argued on page 13 of your brief that the order of the FCC that seems to support your position. Was that argued to the Court of Appeals? Didn't mention that in their analysis, in their opinion. Was that argued to the Court of Appeals? I assume it was.
Yes, it was, and that's one of the major faults of the underlying court's opinion, is that they completely ignored the FCC's controlling orders. All of them were argued, all of them were presented in the briefs, I believe also at oral argument.
The difference between your examples about painters coming in the house and some very good examples of under common law trespass. The difference between your case and that is that you are seeking damages under a specific statute that permits damages.
Correct.
And restricts solicitation.
Yes.
So given that you are using the statute to seek the damages, then you must comply. You can only get the damages if you hit all the elements of that claim. And the argument is that you haven't, by virtue of the continuation of a business, ongoing business relationship. That's your answer to that, is that the FCC rulings have helped you there?
Yes, my answer to that is that this whole issue of deciding how established business relationship should be manifested, the entire matter was turned over to the FCC by explicit statutory language in 227C that gave them a carte blanche to not only pick a regulatory system, whether it was a list or a database, but also to flesh it out with regulations. There was no constraints put on them, and as I quoted to you in the brief, They explicitly emphasized that they were turning over the details of this to the FCC to...
For rulemaking.
For rulemaking, and they followed those, they followed the rulemaking process, they had feedback, they reiterated, they did everything they needed to under the law. If I may continue...
Let me ask you another, you'll find that we ask a lot of questions here, so be prepared for questions. Again, back to the order of the FCC, note 63 says, we emphasize that the business may not make a telephone solicitation to existing former customers, so forth, as they place in the do not call list. And then it says, a customer's request to be placed in the company's do not call list terminates the business relationship between the company and the customer for purpose of future solicitation. Do you see that as requiring that your Sunday subscription is terminated, or would you continue your Sunday subscription to the dispatch?
No, I continue my Sunday subscription. That's not in dispute.
Because it's future solicitation.
Yes, and the language there reads that it terminates their exemption for future solicitation purposes. They've also clarified in the memorandum and opinion order, quote, we emphasize that a request not to be called would also sever an established business relationship. Thus, such a request would obligate a person or entity in an established business relationship with a resident to comply with the rules on telephone solicitation. They've clarified this a number of times.
Seems like the dispatcher's argument relies solely on the continued business relationship. If we found that the statute doesn't require that, or if that is a requirement of the statute, whatever way we decide that, doesn't that decide this case?
Whether or not it does or doesn't sever, with or without having to actually sever the underlying business relationship, is the focus of the case. It's my position that this entire matter was turned over to the FCC. They issued regulations. They clarified it in accordance with my view. That is the whole issue.
The record is clear that at all relevant times an established business relationship existed, and dispositive here was continuous between you and the Columbus Dispatch. Do you agree that that's the dispositive issue?
It's the issue. It's slightly miscast in that there were ongoing business relations, but the established business relationship is a term of art turned over to the FCC by the Congress to define.
So once we look at that and decide that issue, it decides the case.
I agree.
Okay.
Would telling him to leave require you to immediately pay off your continuing mortgage? This is back to the banker example. In order to enforce your right to say, don't come back in my home? Of course not. We have extensively briefed all these things in our appellant and amicus briefs and reply briefs. Because of the U.S. Supreme Court precedent in cases such as Stinson versus the United States and Commission versus Portland, it is manifest error of the lower courts to ignore the FCC's dispositive interpretations. At this point, in order to try and meet my time commitments, I'd like to turn over arguments to amicus.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Charbet. Mr. Biggerstaff.
Thank you. May it please the Court, I'm Robert Biggerstaff, appearing as amicus curiae in support of appellant. Justice Douglas, you cut to the heart of the matter of this case. But I think what was missed by the Court of Appeals is the purpose of statutory construction is to find and effectuate the intent of Congress. I mean, that is the ultimate role of the court. And once that intent is found, for the court must pass on the constitutionality of it. But whether you're talking about the ultimate touchstone or the various other canons of construction, they are all designed not because they're good rules, like the rules of baseball. People didn't make them up. The United States Supreme Court has directed the courts of this country when interpreting federal statutes that these canons of construction are the way to find congressional intent. And in Stinson v. U.S. and the other cases announcing the Stinson Doctrine, when an agency has been delegated authority and the agency promulgates rules and clarifications, those clarifications and those interpretations are binding on a court. The court doesn't have to choose between varying possible interpretations of language. You are given an interpretation by an agency, and it must be the interpretation the court uses. Then the court decides whether that interpretation is constitutional or not. Now, with a statute, if there's more than one interpretation and one interpretation ends up unconstitutional, the court can adopt the constitutional interpretation, even if it may not be the best one, in order to save the statute. But when you have a regulatory agency that's issued clarifications and interpreted its own regulations, you're bound by that. And you must hold it, your only choice is to hold it unconstitutional if it violates the Constitution, or if it violates the clear, if it's clearly an construction that Congress didn't intend. But what we have in this case is not a rogue agency that adopted a construction different than what Congress wrote or wanted. The Congress, in the committee report, which is direct, is on my original amicus brief on page 14, it's the strongly held view of the committee that once a subscriber objects to a business that calls based on an established business relationship, such a business must honor that objection and implement procedures not to call that objecting subscriber again. So the FCC's construction is precisely what Congress wanted to work here. So following the construction of the FCC is a form of deference to congressional intent. Matter of fact, if you look at the definitions in the statute defines a lot of terms of art. There was one term of art, established business relationship, that was actually was in the statute in the bill. They took it out because it was a political hot potato. And if you look on page 13 and 14 of my amicus brief, we have some of the debate on the floor of the Senate between Mr. Pressler and Gore, where they said, yes, we took that out of the statute and we want the FCC to define that term.
Would it be fair to say that the analysis or the determination by the FCC is in contradiction to the explicit wording of the statute?
Absolutely not.
Why?
Because the statute uses a term of art, established business relationship. That's not a term that's been defined by other statutes. It's not a term that has any judicial history. And certainly, you cannot parse a term into individual language or into individual words and analyze them that way. Words have context. This is a term of art that Congress specifically said, we want the FCC to define this term. And the FCC did so. And on the same page in the report and order where that definition is created are the notes that y'all have been referring to, apologize for my southern drawl, Your Honor, that says, we emphasize that once you tell a business to stop, they can no longer use the fact that you continue to do business as an exemption. You've
so
closed that.
So it boils down to, you say what the FCC says about established business relationship is what's binding here. He says, or will tell us, as he has in his brief, just read the words. Anybody can read them.
And if the FCC,
time as they're written.
And if the FCC did not exist in this case or had not promulgated anything, it would be your job to decide that. But under Stinson v. U.S.
It would be our job to decide what? That language is pretty clear.
In the absence of the FCC's opinion. Remember, in Stinson, the United States Supreme Court says that the FCC's or the agency's opinions explain the guidelines and provide concrete guidance as to how even unambiguous guidelines are to be applied. This is not Chevron deference, where you show deference to the agency.
Yeah.
This is controlling. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Biggerstaff. Mr. Little.
May it please the court, counsel, Mr. Charbot. My name is Marion Little and I represent the Columbus Dispatch and Dispatch Consumer Services. I start the argument today with somewhat of a disadvantage, and that's because I represent a company that engages in phone solicitations. And many members of the public, of course, have disdain for phone solicitations. And I would not be surprised to venture to say that members of this court also have the same personal views that members of the public at large have towards phone solicitation. And that perhaps explains why, in the course of these proceedings and in all these type of cases, there's an effort to lump together all phone solicitors in one group and cast them as being bad and ignore the fact that there are legitimate business reasons for phone solicitations. What the U.S. Congress has said is, no, you should not lump them all together. We're not going to outlaw phone solicitations. We're going to regulate it. We're going to allow some. And in fact, one of the things we're going to allow is that those companies that have a continued business relationship with a customer will still have the right to make those type of solicitations. And they made it very explicit in the statute. And they, in fact, exempted from...
How do you explain away, then, the committee notes that say, which seems perfectly logical, you have a Hobson's choice under your theory that you either get the paper and suffer the phone calls, or you stop getting the paper, whereas the committee notes clearly say if you tell them, stop, I still want to do business with you, but I don't want you calling me. Do you ignore that comment entirely?
Your Honor, there's a couple things I'll say about FCC comments. And there's been a lot of references to...
Now, that was not an FCC comment. That was a committee note comment.
Well,
the FCC promulgated regulations that are identical to that comment, but that was not an FCC comment.
Fair enough. Those committee notes that they referenced, the ones that were made by former Senator Gore, were in fact comments that were made with respect to a prior version of the statute. And in that prior version of the statute, there was nothing that said established business relationship. That was not in the statute. What existed under that prior statute was language saying that it was up to the FCC to define telephone solicitations. That's the prior version. Now we have in the current version, which Congress specifically established that exception. And then it took one further step. It said it'll be up to the FCC to define it. But please understand, in defining what that means, that exception stands. And if for at any reason
the FCC that's defining the words, isn't it?
Yes.
Congress did not define the term. That's and left that to an administrative agency, which has the force of law, doesn't it? Would you agree?
I don't disagree with that general proposition, Your Honor. The significant point, though, is in Section 227C1D, Congress took the next step and said, we're going to allow you to define this term. But please understand, if you believe that the exception that has been established for existing business relationships is too broad, you need to make findings, and then you need to come back to the United States Congress and
you
tell
meaning
us that
who is you now? Who is you?
FCC.
Okay. If FCC believes it's too broad?
That's exactly what it says in 227C1D, where the Congress charged the FCC with responsibility for determining whether there was a need for additional authority to further restrict telephone solicitations. And it made an explicit reference in the statute to those calls exempted under Section A3. That's the subsection that includes the established business relationship exception enacted by the United States Congress. Now, and let me follow up on the earlier comment of what deference should be accorded to the FCC. They're right with the general statement that, yes, you accord deference to an administrative agency with respect to its regulations, but that presupposes a number of things. First, that the FCC has actually spoken on the issue. Second, that the FCC's interpretation is consistent with the Congressional Act. Three, that the FCC's interpretation is consistent with the regulation that it ultimately enacted. And four, that the construction that the FCC would like to apply is consistent with the United States Constitution. Those are the four hurdles that have to be satisfied before one concludes you should accord deference to an administrative finding or administrative comment. The comments that are relied upon in this case are two footnotes. Two footnotes that are found in commentary to a regulation. And it takes a real strain to conclude that's a clear statement by the FCC as to what their interpretation is of this particular provision. And the reason I say that is, yes, you can take phrases out of those footnotes, and they seem to support their position, but you have to understand how the FCC in the first instance defined an established business relationship. It defined it very broadly. It included, to the extent there were simply a solicitation, a contact by the customer in the first instance with the business. That in itself gives rise to an existing business relationship. So it's no surprise that in that context, someone could terminate that relationship, giving the breadth of the definition, by simply saying, please do not put me, or please place me on a do not call list.
Let me see if I understand you. If the FCC were sitting here and asked a specific question, you'd say, the FCC would say, he loses.
No, I won't agree to that, Your Honor. And the reason I won't agree
is because that's not the way I read it.
Because I don't think you can reach that interpretation by simply looking at this footnotes and reaching that conclusion. I don't think that's how you get there.
So you think probably the intention of the FCC was to do what he says they did?
I don't think the FCC has spoken with any degree of clarity on this particular point. The only thing the FCC has in fact said with respect to this issue is that we do not want to participate in this lawsuit. They were offered the opportunity by the appellant on numerous occasions at the Court of Appeals level. Please participate. That's all in the record. And the Department of Justice, on behalf of the FCC, sent a letter. It's in the file, says, we don't want to participate.
That wouldn't be unusual, Counselor. You know that.
They had the benefit of the Court of Appeals decision. If, in fact, the FCC thought there was some injustice as a consequence of this,
that'd be like any state agency getting a letter when there are rules in play or an issue and saying, would you be a party or come to? They don't do that, do they?
Well,
forget what the Attorney General's doing. Just you come out and tell us.
I appreciate that. And my point is simply this. You can't necessarily conclude that the FCC would adopt my position by the fact they haven't intervened, but you can't necessarily conclude that they would adopt the position of the appellant because I don't think they've spoken with any clarity on that. And again,
they've spoken, but in your mind, it's not clear enough. It's muddled. The footnotes seem pretty clear.
Yeah.
I guess the question of whether the footnotes define what their intent was or whether we should ignore footnotes.
I think that the starting point with the FCC's interpretation is with the language that they adopted after you had a process of issuing proposed rules, after you go through the rulemaking process. What was the specific language adopted by the FCC? And the language they adopted said there had to be a termination of the relationship. That's what it says in the administrative code provision. It doesn't say a termination of the right to make telephone calls. It simply says a termination of the relationship. And we've made a number of comments in our briefs as to why our conclusion's correct, ranging from what does the plain language of the statute and the regulation say, what are the practical consequences of our interpretation versus their interpretation, and three, what are the constitutional ramifications. But I think the one issue that speaks the loudest is the one about what are the practical consequences of our construction. What's the difference between a person who has an established business relationship and a person who does not?
Okay, and I want to get to that issue because my concern is what you're telling us, I think, what I think affirming this would do, see if I'm right, I have an established business relationship with the dispatch. I get their paper. I pay them. That means I can never stop those calls at dinner time three nights a week. Isn't that right?
You can only stop them when you decide to terminate the business relationship. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But the practical difference
is... Isn't that exactly what Note 63 says? Isn't Note 63 contrary to that? We emphasize that a business may not make telephone solicitations existing. Customer who is asked to be placed on that company's do not call list. Customer's request be placed terminates the business relationship between the company and that customer for the purpose of any future solicitation. That suggests that you can keep the Sunday dispatch, but don't call me about future business, isn't that what, no, note 63, we don't have, obviously neither of you has given us the, you know, the primary authority here, we'll find it, but you quoted from it, but so note 63 is note 63, I guess, to, I'm reading from the appellant's brief, the 7 FCC 2736, that citation. What's your response to that? Your brief, well, I mean, your brief, in your brief you indicate that language refers, I think as I understand, I want to make sure I understand it, that refers to business relationships that are created by telephone. Is that, am I reading your brief correctly? And I'd like you to explain that.
Yes, Your Honor. It's consistent with my remarks earlier that what constitutes an established business relationship under the FCC regulations is very broad. It includes relationships that are traditional, like the dispatch and an ongoing subscriber. It also includes relationships that we had a subscriber for the dispatch who terminated their relationship 3 years ago. Under the definition enacted by the FCC, we could, consistent with the exception, contact that customer. I think what those footnotes refer to is the fact, in that context, if there's not an ongoing relationship, yes, they can certainly terminate the business relationship or that particular exception by simply saying, do not put me on a call list. But I don't think that necessarily addresses the situation in which there is a continued relationship.
Let me see if I can understand the do not call. I mean, there's like some sort of national do not call list that solicitors can look to, is that correct?
There is not a national database, Your Honor. That was one option that was considered by the FCC. And in fact, a lot of the congressional history that is cited by the appellant in his brief refers to a situation in which they were actually considering a database approach. That approach was not adopted. What was ultimately adopted was an approach by which Marion Little could be called at home by Lazarus or Sears, and when I was contacted at home, I could ask Lazarus or Sears to put me on a do not call list. And that means that once I request to be placed on a do not call list with Lazarus or Sears, those two companies cannot call me after making that request. Now,
if I have a Lazarus charge card, they can call me, right?
Right, they can continue to call you and say, we're offering a promotion. If you use your credit, your Lazarus credit
so
card this month.
Every company has a credit card with every bank, every gas station, every whatever I have do business with, under your theory, can keep calling me if I don't want to.
And if there's a problem with that, the FCC has statutory authority to address that. Because again, Congress has said, if the exception established for the established business relationship is too broad, all you need to do is go back to Congress and tell it's too broad. And then you could address those situations in which it's the utility companies, it's someone else you otherwise could not avoid having a relationship with. In that context, the FCC has the authority to go back to Congress and say, this exception's too broad. But the best I can figure, they've not done that.
Maybe they think they've done it through the regulations and they don't have a problem.
I disagree with that. I understand the court's view. But I think the most practical purpose, or and the reason it shows exactly why we're right, if you look to see what are the differences, I said if I was Marion Little was called by Lazarus, I could be placed on a do not call list, irrespective of whether I had a relationship with Lazarus. Under the view of the appellant, the same is true. If I had an established relationship with Lazarus, I could also be placed on a do not call. I could ask to be placed on a do not call list and stop them. If that's the case, what's the benefit, what's the purpose of having the exception in the first instance? They've identified three reasons in their brief why it makes sense to reach this type of conclusion. Of those three, only one of them has no application because he said, well, it means that those people who are subject to an established business relationship can make pre-recorded phone calls. That's wrong. When you look at the regulations, you'll see that applies to all telephone calls. So the only distinctions that exist for those who have an established business relationship and those who do not is that the person with the established business relationship, under their construction, can't call before the hours of 8, it can't call after the, I'm sorry, can call before the hours of 8 in the morning, and now can call after 9 p.m., and do not have to provide their names and addresses or the phone number of the person initiating the phone call. That would be the only difference. And if that was the only difference in terms of these two constructions, that effectively renders the established business relationship exception a nullity. It has no application. And I see that my time is up, so I will conclude my argument, and for the balance of it, simply respectfully refer the court to my brief.
Thank you, Mr. Little. Mr. Sherratt, you've saved 2 minutes of your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Biggerstaff.
I want to adjust something that Justice Lindbergh-Stratton said, talk about the National Do Not Call database. That was an option, and as a matter of fact, Congress expressly thought the FCC was going to take that option. And what defendant referred to about the additional exemptions that the FCC could come back to Congress for additional exemptions was predicated on the fact that there were people, especially newspapers, who, and actually got this in an earlier version of the bill, wanted an exemption for second-class mail holders because they are local mailers and they felt they would be subject to local peer pressure, essentially, to behave good as telemarketers. That was the exemption, and if you're somebody like me who's been reading this legislative history and everything written about this statute for 4 years, you realize that that's the type of additional exemption they were talking about. The FCC did precisely what Congress said. A couple of misstatements he said. The quote from Senator Gore is from the floor of the Senate. That's not what I quote. The other thing I quoted was from the committee report, which even some of the justices like Scalia, who eschew certain reliance on legislative history, the committee reports, they still rely on. They are a higher authority. He also was wrong about pre-records. There is an exemption for making pre-recorded telephone calls for someone with an established business relationship. It's not in the statute. It was an exemption created by the FCC, which they were authorized to do. But you also look at the public policy here. If an established business relationship exists in this context, they can call you at any hour of the day. They don't have to tell you who they are, and it's going to apply to everybody everywhere that you've ever done business with. Justice, you said that's a Hobson's choice. I don't think I should have to live the life of Ted Kaczynski out in a cabin in the woods to stop the telemarketers, and the FCC doesn't either. The FCC's opinion is very clear. It is precisely what Congress in the committee report, not some rogue legislator on the floor of the Senate, said. The FCC's published FCC record citation, that's the way the FCC officially publishes all of their orders. They have the force of law, and they are the official publications of the committee. I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Biggerstaff. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.